From the Schmoes No Network Studios in Los Angeles, California, it's time for Profiles with your hosts, Alicia Malone and Scott Mantz.
Hello, Schmoville!
Welcome to episode 3 of Profiles with Malone and Mantz. I'm the Malone.
And I'm the Mantz. And finally, finally, we're going to talk about one of our favorite directors of all time, Stanley Kubrick.
I am so excited about this. We get to geek out about one of our favorite filmmakers for about an hour, maybe even longer if we can push it. Why would you say he is one of the most visionary filmmakers of all time?
Well, that is a loaded question that we're going to answer over the next hour.
Tell me now.
Maybe more. But since you asked, listen, this is a filmmaker who's very mysterious, reclusive. A lot of people say he's a perfectionist, demanding. Obviously, his 13 films that he directed, 13 movies, they are all completely different. They are all beautifully shot. They all hold up under repeated viewings to the point where you get something else out of it every time you watch it. But what does it, why is Kubrick your jam?
He is my jam for sure, because he can tackle any genre. And he does. He tried all different genres, and each one, as you said, was perfection because of the level of detail. He did intense research for every single film. There is so much to look at in his movies. Everything is intentional, and I do like that he was a bit of an enigma. It's hard to say, an enigma, because he was reclusive and we didn't know too much about him, and then that led to some really interesting conspiracy theories.
Oh yeah, we're going to get into that in this episode of Profiles. This is going to be a fun one. But you know, you mentioned how he's an enigma, mm-hmm. and about how not a lot of people really knew him. Did he even know himself? I don't know. But our friend the Pit Boss is going to shed some light on the situation. Who is Stanley Kubrick anyway?
Let's listen to our It's a Wonderful Life. Take it away, Ken.
Stanley Kubrick was born on July 26, 1928 in the Bronx in New York City to his father, Jack, and mother, Sadie. When he was 12, he developed a lifelong obsession with chess, but it was the following year that his life would change forever. His father gave him a camera, and at the age of 17, he became an apprentice photographer for Look magazine. Kubrick directed his first feature, Fear and Desire, in 1953, and up until the time of his death at the age of 70, he would come to direct some of the greatest movies of all time. Yet, despite being nominated by the Academy for Best Director 4 times, he never won an Oscar in that category. At least he's in good company, since Alfred Hitchcock, Orson Welles, and Charlie Chaplin also never won Best Director Oscars. Kubrick is survived by 3 children and his wife, Christiane Kubrick.
How is that possible?
I have no idea. And it's unbelievable when you look at the standard of his movies that he never won a Best Director Oscar at all. And he should have won one for his production design, his like cinematography. I think because he came from a photography background, that's why he has some of the most memorable films and the memorable movie moments in those movies.
Well, also when you look at some of the directors today, like Christopher Nolan, David Fincher, mm-hmm. these are directors who absolutely just look at their body of work, are deserving of a Best Director Oscar, and they haven't won yet. But for the love of God, for Stanley Kubrick, 2001 A Space Odyssey, to not win an Oscar for directing that movie, I don't get it.
But seems insane.
What was, in our same we like to call first blood, mm-hmm. what was your first blood? What was your first Stanley Kubrick movie?
My first Stanley Kubrick movie was 2001, A Space Odyssey. I didn't see that till I was a teenager, and I wanted to check it out because of all the pop culture references and other things, especially The Simpsons. Yeah. They would always make fun of Stanley Kubrick movies. They were huge Kubrick fans. So I saw 2001. I didn't get it at all. I may have pretended that I did,
okay.
but I totally didn't understand. There was the apes, and then suddenly you're in space, and then the monolith. I didn't know what was going on, but I definitely appreciated the special effects. Even though I saw it in the 80s, it still looked fantastic, and it still does today.
The special effects are amazing. But when you see all the pop culture references on a movie like 2001 in other places, mm-hmm. and then you go to the source... When you go to the source and watch a movie like that, you're like, oh,
I get it now.
I get it.
What was your first blood?
Okay, Leash, check this out. My first Stanley Kubrick movie was in 1980. the year The Shining came out, my parents, in their infinite wisdom, took a 12-year-old kid, this guy, to see The Shining. What the hell were they thinking?
I'm surprised you're not damaged. You're very upbeat.
Well, just keep that in mind. But every time for years after the fact, when I would watch The Tonight Show and Ed McMahon would say, "Here's Johnny," I would go, "Ah, ah," because that movie was traumatizing.
Absolutely.
I didn't sleep for months.
So traumatizing.
That was my first Kubrick movie. Whoa.
Well, now Jete always joins us in the control room. And I know you are a huge Kubrick fan. Do you remember your first?
Wow, my first. I would probably have to say, I think it was 2001 Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
And I had a friend whose father was from London. And we would go over his house and watch movies, and he brought it out. And I always describe it as a hypnotizing film. Because I don't know exactly what's happening, but I can't take my eyes off the screen.
It's true. Yeah. That is very true. It took me ages to figure it out. And I think I'm still figuring it out.
I have it down. And I will tell you what this movie is about. Later in the show.
In the show. Let's get into our Fast Five with our fifth favorite Kubrick movie, which is, Jete?
What is your major malfunction, numbnuts?
Full
Metal Jacket.
1987. This was a war film, and I really love Full Metal Jacket because it shows the different facets and the different horrors of being a Marine.
Right.
You've got the boot camp, which is insane. I can't imagine someone yelling all those insults at me. I would probably cry. Then you've got the boredom of war, and then finally the horrors of war and the confusion of war.
This really is two movies in one, and they're both mesmerizing, riveting, totally engrossing, and the boot camp scene, the boot camp sections, I gotta say, a lot of people feel like that's the better part of the film, and it's hard to top that because of Audley Ermy's performance as Sergeant Hartman.
Yes.
So incredible. What a great character. I mean, he is just shouting insults the entire time.
Yeah, and did you know he wrote most of those insults himself? You know, Kubrick was very particular about his own scripts and rarely would he let anyone else write them.
Oh,
but
sure, yeah.
After after he auditioned for the role, he was originally supposed to be just a technical advisor, but then he auditioned and he just flung insults at a group of extras and they showed how brutal he could be. Then he wrote 150 pages worth of insults. About half of those end up in the film.
And he got the job.
Yes.
But so many great scenes in this movie. I mean, who can forget the scene in the latrine just before they cut to Vietnam when Vincent D'Onofrio, as a private pile, has lost his mind. And he's sitting there with his fully loaded rifle, Full Metal Jacket.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sergeant Hartman comes in and says that line that we just heard. What is your major malfunction? And boom, and then turns the gun on himself in front of Private Joker.
Yeah, was played brilliantly by Matthew Modine. And we will be talking to him a little later on. It was also, that role was supposed to go to Anthony Michael Hall.
Interesting,
but negotiations broke down after 8 months. And Kubrick apparently also offered a role to Bruce Willis.
But what role was it?
I have no idea, but he had to turn it down because of moonlighting.
Oh,
but I loved Matthew Modine in that role. I loved Vincent in his role. He put on 70 pounds to play Private Pyle. Broke the record because I think Robert De Niro put on 60 pounds.
For Raging Bull.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. But this another great scene in this movie, you know, the second part of the film with the sniper. It's just so intense. And then when you finally see that the sniper is a woman, it just really just hits home. It's really, really great.
Well, we asked Schmoville for some responses to Full Metal Jacket, and Maxence Vincent says, it has to be the best Vietnam War movie, in my opinion. The boot camp part is amazing. Even the second half I liked a lot. For me, it's a perfect film.
Well, Rachel J. Cushing, our friend from Schmoville, said, the first time I saw Full Metal Jacket, I remember being truly frightened by what I was watching. You're not the only one. I had only ever seen school heroic World War II movies up to that point. It was the first film for me that showed the psychological and emotional impact of war culture, and now in a weird way I find the film incredibly moving. Rachel, that's a very interesting observation.
All right, so Kubrick has given us many memorable scenes.
Definitely.
So in The Right Stuff, I'm going to talk about my favorite scene.
Which is?
Really hard to choose because there are so many great scenes in Kubrick films, but I'm going to go with the tricycle scene in The Shining.
Ooh, yeah.
You'll notice that I'm wearing the Apollo 11 t-shirt, very similar to Danny's, and he was on the tricycle. The camera is following him as he races around the Overlook Hotel. I love the sound in that section, how he goes from running on the, you know, rolling on the carpet to rolling on the boards the and floor, then back yeah. to the carpet again. I also love how the camera goes behind him because it just elevates that sense of dread. You do not know what's around the corner and you're expecting something around every corner and then suddenly the twins.
Oh, hello, Danny.
Come play with us.
Come play with us forever.
So terrifying.
And ever. And ever.
And that sticks in my mind. And even though now I know exactly when they're going to show up, I still get scared.
It's still scary, it even still after scary. All these years, right?
Yes.
And you're right, the sound of when he's riding and it goes from the smoothness of the rug
yeah.
to the sound of the hardwood floors. It's just like every little thing about that scene just builds the intensity.
It does. Now, hit me with some trivia.
You want some trivia? You want the last detail?
Yeah, that's what we're going to call the last trivia detail, segment now.
Alicia Malone.
Yes,
that's
I do.
That's an exclusive. Our trivia the part is going to be called the last detail.
Yep.
Speaking of The Shining, now, you know the movie Toy Story 3?
Uh-huh.
Okay, the director of that film, Lee Unkrich, is apparently obsessed with The Shining.
Oh.
Here's this movie, Toy Story 3. Which is just a wonderful film, one of the best animated movies of the last 25 years, and its director is obsessed with The Shining. He runs a website called theoverlookhotel.com, which is updated all the time with news, with unreleased photos, and with all these fan-made one-sheets and images. People were so inspired by The Shining that there's a website dedicated to it. It's theoverlookhotel.com. Check it out.
Well, I think I remember reading that inside Toy Story 3, there are some hidden 237s.
Oh, no kidding.
Number plates and things. I'm not entirely sure, but Schmoville, tell us if you've spotted any. That's really interesting.
Now I have to go back and watch Toy Story 3.
Well, did you know Eyes Wide Shut has a Guinness World Record for the longest constant movie shoot? 400 days it took to shoot that film.
400 days
uh-huh.
to shoot Eyes Wide Shut. A
yep.
movie that you didn't really love.
No. I don't know if it was worth 400 days. But anyway, the cast was going a little bit crazy, needlessly said.
Well, I like that movie a lot,
mm-hmm.
and I'll tell you why shortly. But did you know that the footage at the beginning of The Shining,
yeah.
when they're flying over Glacial National Park.
Montana,
and they're playing that wah, wah, wah,
yep.
wah, 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 wah. I mean, that music is so scary. But Stanley Kubrick shot so much of that footage that wound up not being used. So when Ridley Scott was making Blade Runner
mm-hmm.
in 1982, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. The original ending of that film had a lot of aerial footage that was not used by Stanley Kubrick.
And
he used it. But keep in mind, this was in the original cut of Blade Runner when
right.
he released the director's cut 10 years later. That tacked on ending was chopped off and that footage we don't see anymore.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, Kubrick has another Guinness World Record.
What's that?
It is for the greatest number of takes for a scene with dialogue. 127 takes.
Which
of
one?
Shelley Duvall in The Shining swinging a bat at Jack Nicholson.
So when they're going up the steps, right?
Uh-huh.
And she's backing up. Get away from me! Get away from me!
I mean, apparently he pushed her to the edge.
You could see that.
Yeah, she was going a little bit crazy by the end.
But you could see that in the documentary,
mm-hmm.
Stanley Kubrick, Life in Pictures, which is a great documentary.
Yeah, if you're a Kubrick fan, you should watch it. It's like 2 hours and 20 minutes of heaven.
And it came out in 2001,
yeah.
as it should. But yeah, that's where Jack Nicholson goes. Wendy, it's okay. I just want to bash your brains
oh,
in.
Creepy.
Oh, it's so great.
Well,
so
that
great.
Leads us nicely to the number 4 movie in our Fast Five, Jeté.
Here's Johnny.
Oh.
Like I said.
Terrifying.
You hear that? And you just cannot imagine watching The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson the same way again for years.
I love how that line is improvised, too, by Jack Nicholson.
He improvised that line.
Yeah.
No kidding.
And it's one of the most famous lines from any Kubrick film.
So that line was improvised, yet it took them 3 days to shoot that scene.
Oh my gosh.
And they went through more than 60 doors until he got it just right.
Oh God, yeah. You got to get everything right on a Kubrick film. This came out in 1980. It's a psychological horror, and horror was a genre that Kubrick was really interested in. He always wanted to make his own horror. He actually pitched to make The Exorcist, but they said no because he wanted to produce it as well as direct it and have complete control. So they said no, forget about it. So he decided that he wanted to make a movie that would terrify everyone. And The Shining did it. I find this so scary just because of the images. The things you see in this movie do not leave your head.
No, they really don't. There's so many great scenes in this film. Obviously, the one that we talked about just before with the big wheel and the tricycle. But there is the scene in room 237. Room 237 right here on my t-shirt. The scene when Jack Nicholson goes in the room and the woman gets out of the bathtub and she's like perfect woman. And then he kisses her. And then she's like laughing. And it's an old woman who's like all decomposed.
Yeah,
and she's got the... That's scary, right?
Freaked me out.
But also the scene that I like in that movie is in the bathroom, in the gold room, when the waiter spills the drink on Jack Torrance. And he goes, I know you. You're Grady. You were the caretaker here. And then Grady says, no, sir. You are the caretaker. Yeah. You have always been the caretaker here.
What?
Oh, it's so freaky. It's so great. Did you know about this movie? Okay. It got very mixed reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And amazingly, it's based on the book by Stephen King. And Stephen King didn't like the movie.
No, he actually wrote a draft of the screenplay. Kubrick never read it.
No way.
They
never
get along very well. Apparently, in one of the scenes, I think when Halloran is going to the Overlook Hotel, you can see a red VW Beetle that's been squished. That is the car that Stephen King had them drive on the way to Overlook Hotel. So that was like a little subtle, screw you.
No
I
way.
This.
Way.
Yeah.
But also about this film. Okay, it didn't win any Oscars, but it was nominated for two... I'm going to say this right now. The Shining was nominated for two Razzie Awards.
What?
Crazy, right? It was worst director and worst actress for Shelley Duvall.
Oh my God.
And yet, it is a masterpiece of modern horror. It's one next to The Exorcist, I think the scariest movie of all time.
I agree. And little Dan Lloyd did such a good job. He was only 5 years old when they shot it. He didn't even know it was a horror because Kubrick told him that it was just a drama. And then he didn't see the completed film till he was 16. And then he finally saw what he was making.
Can you imagine?
No.
You finally get to see the movie.
Imagine.
You're like, oh.
Like, oh,
that's the movie I made when I was a little kid.
Well, Liam Alexander from Schmoville said, what Kubrick did with The Shining was nothing short of sensational. He was able to create such a creepy atmosphere. Yes. Instead of making a straight out horror film, he created a deep psychological film with an incredible performance by Nicholson. I think he hits the nail on the head. That's exactly why it doesn't leave your head, is because it's psychological. It's
totally
really terrifying.
It really is terrifying. And our friend Tyler Myers from Schmoville says, it's a very atmospheric, definitely atmospheric, and creepy film filled with extreme tension and iconic shots like the twins in the hallway. We agree. Jack Nicholson gives an unsettling and haunting performance that has been going through a wide range of emotions that fit in very well with the tone of this terrifying yet brilliant film. Tyler Myers, I have to say to you, sir, you wrote this comment like you are an aspiring film critic yourself. I am very, very impressed with that. And then there's one more comment here from our friend Tyler Moore in Schmoville. This is not so much a comment. This one is a request.
Okay.
He says, I really hope Alicia says, here's Johnny in her amazing Australian accent.
Oh, my Australian accent?
Yes. So, okay on three.
It's not going to be very scary.
Two, one.
Here's Johnny.
That sounds good to me,
not that
Tyler
scary.
Moore.
Not that scary at all. But, you know, Kubrick made great movies, and then he also made great...
movie posters.
And what are we calling this segment now?
We're calling it The Big Picture.
We came up with a title.
Yes.
And to help us with this is the Pit Boss Ken Knapsack. Roll it, Chate.
Some of the one-sheets for Stanley Kubrick's movies are just as unforgettable as the films themselves. Graphic designer Bill Gold, whose iconic posters also include Alien and Casablanca, designed this chilling one-sheet for A Clockwork Orange, in which Malcolm McDowell's sinister smile as the dagger-bearing Alex provided a glimpse of the disturbing violence moviegoers were about to see. More minimal, but even more terrifying, was this one-sheet for The Shining, designed by the legendary Sal Bass. Despite his iconic work on one-sheets for the likes of Vertigo and Anatomy of a Murder, Kubrick made Bass go through at least 300 versions of The Shining until he finally settled on this haunting image. And back in the late 1960s, when the space race was in full swing, what college dorm room wall wasn't graced with this breathtaking one-sheet featuring the giant space station from 2001, A Space Odyssey, painted by artist Robert McCall? No wonder they called it The Ultimate Trip.
Oh, I love those movie posters. Clockwork Orange is my favorite of those.
Yeah, Clockwork Orange. I just remember seeing the movie poster for The Shining in the newspapers and seeing that image of that face, that horrified face. I mean, is it Danny Lloyd? Is it Jack Torrance? I mean, it's just really, really terrifying. But we just want to take a second right now, tell all our friends watching that we need your help. It's very, very important. Please go to iTunes and review us, rate us. We need that to survive so we can come back every week with profiles.
Yes.
Malone and I, we love movies. We know you do too. Mm-hmm. We have so many great people we want to talk about. A lot of them suggested by you. Martin Scorsese, Quentin Tarantino. Oh,
cannot wait.
Can't wait for those.
And make sure you subscribe to YouTube/SchmoesNo podcast. That's where you can find all the podcasts from the SchmoesNo network. There's some good ones there.
There's some good ones. Yeah, they're great.
All right. Keeping going with our next segment we're calling
The Player,
which is this week, it's all about best characters.
The best Kubrick characters.
So let's start with Jack Torrance.
Let's start with Jack Torrance.
From The Shining.
He is one of the best.
He is one of the best because of Nicholson, I say, because Nicholson played him so well, just that unraveling slowly. And I like what's happening inside his mind is also kind of happening in the hotel at the same time.
At the same time.
It's very clever.
See, the interesting thing about The Shining, I forgot to mention this before, is that for the longest time, you really feel like this could be just all in his mind.
Yeah.
But here's where you realize that it's not. When he's locked up in the storage room and Grady's on the other side of the door telling him he has to take care of the problem, telling him he has to get rid of his wife, then you hear somebody unlock the door.
Mm.
Who was it? I just got the chills just talking about that right now.
God,
now,
yeah.
Some people say that it was a genuinely haunted hotel. Other people say that it was Danny who unlocked the door. Either way, it is chilling. But Jack Nicholson was so great as Jack Torrance that for a few years, it was hard to see him as anything else. And it wasn't until 1983 with Terms of Endearment, when he won Best Supporting Actor, that people finally got past Jack Torrance.
Yeah, and Stephen King didn't like his casting either.
Ah, I mean, what's not to like? He's perfect.
Come on, Stephen. Another character I love is Alex DeLarge from Clockwork Orange.
Yep.
He loves a bit of the old ultraviolence with his milk and his eggy wigs. Malcolm McDowell is so brilliant in this character. I mean, he is a psychopath, Alex.
Yes.
Yeah, he is violent. He enjoys a bit of rape and murder. Somehow, you still feel for him when he's trying to be changed. And I think that character shows how people can't always be changed.
But also, it shows how Malcolm McDowell's performance as Alex, he's charming. He's irresistible. Mm-hmm. He's persuasive.
Yeah,
which makes him, yeah, very charismatic. That's what makes him such a complex character, because there's so many things to not like about him,
yeah,
yet you can't help but root for him.
Yeah, you feel empathy for him when he's being changed with the grr,
yeah,
the eye things.
Well, you also feel a lot of empathy for our number one Cooper character, which isn't even a human being. This is the HAL 9000 computer from 2001 A Space Odyssey. Many argue, rightfully so, that HAL is the most human character in that film.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we realize that at the point when Dave Bowman is deactivating his logic, yeah, circuit, and he starts saying,
I'm afraid.
I'm afraid.
I'm afraid.
I'm afraid. My mind is going. And he starts to, Daisy, Daisy.
So creepy.
But yeah, it's very creepy. And here's this film where all the human characters after the Dawn of Man sequence are very detached. They're very mechanical, just like the technology that they have become consumed by. Mm-hmm. Yet this mechanical, artificial, intelligent character displays more humanity than anyone else.
I think it's really interesting how he's just a sort of red eye and then a very calm voice, but you attribute what he's thinking throughout the film. And it starts out being quite reassuring. Someone's always watching you, looking after you. He's always very calm, doesn't have that annoying human emotions.
Right.
Then towards the end, it becomes terrifying that he has complete control of the ship.
Every time I watch this movie, every time I watch 2001, okay, the scene when Dave and Frank are in the pod and they turned off all the sounds.
So lip-reading?
The lip-reading. Mm. Every single time I see that movie on the big screen, and that's a lot because whenever it's playing on the big screen, I'll stop what I'm doing to go see it. But every single time you hear the audience go, oh no.
Howls onto them.
Howls onto them. And then it breaks for an intermission.
Oh.
And then it comes back and all hell breaks loose and Jupiter beyond the infinity. But, Alicia Milano, it's time to test your real knowledge. Your real knowledge. How much do you really know Stanley Kubrick? Shatay, can we get some quiz show music going on here?
No quiz show music, happy about because it's scary. But actually,
we're going to hold off on quiz show for a second because
something so exciting.
We are very, very excited to join us on Profiles today. Matthew Modine from Full Metal Jacket played Private Joker. You're on with Alicia and Scott. It is so great. Thank you so much for joining us today. We're thrilled to have you on the show.
It's my pleasure. How are you guys doing today?
We're
really
doing great.
Good. So excited to talk to you. Now, can you first kick things off with talking about your app that you have made about the making of Full Metal Jacket? I love the sound of this.
Well, well, first of all, you should tell everybody that it's available on iTunes, and
yes,
it's for an iPad. It's a beautiful rendition of the book that was a limited edition book that came out several years ago. There were only one of 20,000 of those books made with a metal cover. And I was approached by a young guy, excuse me, from Apple Computers, arguably a real genius, not a genius working at the Genius Bar, but a real genius that worked under the tutelage of Steve Jobs, who asked me, what if I could make your book into an app?
Wow.
I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, I'll take all the photographs, everything that you have, any letters that Stanley wrote you, personal items from the time, and do high-res scans of them, and then I'll have you record the book, and then we'll have somebody record an original score for the app, and we'll create sound effects and create something that's never been done before, create a very deeply immersive app.
Well, I want to get
now it. Been, yeah. Which has now been called an appumentary. And,
oh, that's excellent. I love that word.
and the goal was always to create something that would be of Stanley Kubrick's quality, of his standard of excellence. And I really believe that everybody involved with the making of the app accomplished that.
Well, it sounds fantastic, and I know everyone listening and watching Profiles today is this is going to be right up their alley. But I just want to flash back to the beginning of your Full Metal Jacket experience. How did you come to be cast in this movie, and what was your first impression of Stanley Kubrick when you met him?
Well, it was kind of by accident, and I talk about it in the book and in the app that I'm. I was at a restaurant with a friend of mine, David Alan Greer, a really wonderful, talented comedian and actor. And there was an actor sitting opposite me in the restaurant who appeared to be kind of cursing directly in my direction, calling me names. And I said to David, I said, either this guy's an actor learning his lines or he's got Tourette. But he's looking at me, calling me, calling me names right to my face. And he looked over his shoulder. He goes, oh, that's Val Kilmer. He's a really nice guy. So he got up and he went over and he started talking to Val, and David waved me over and said, come here, I'll introduce you to Val. I said, hey, my name's Matthew. And he goes, yeah, I know who you are. I'm sick of you. And apparently he'd been up auditioning for many of the films that I had done, and now he'd heard that I was doing Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket, which, of course, I didn't know anything about. You had to audition for Stanley. You had to send him a VHS tape with a scene of your work, and I hadn't done that, and obviously Val had. excuse me, I've got a frog in my throat. Of course, the long story short was when I left the restaurant, I called up my agent and asked him if he knew anything about it, and he said he didn't. And I said, well, you know, Alan Parker is editing Birdie in London right now. We could call him and have him send over a scene, and we'll call Warner Brothers and ask them to send a scene from Vision Quest or send him the movie. And about, I don't know, less than a month later, I received a script in the mail from Stanley Kubrick asking me if I'd be in his movie. So in many ways, Val Kilmer may be responsible for my having got the part in the film.
Time to pay it forward.
That's incredible. And it had been 7 years since Kubrick made The Shining before Full Metal Jacket. Do you know why he waited so long in between films?
I think he was always looking for good material. There may have been, and I'm sure there were, several projects that he considered in between Full Metal Jacket and The Shining, because he was always working on something. But he'd wanted to make Eyes Wide Shut for a couple decades.
Wow.
So, and I think Michael Hare, the man who wrote the narration in Apocalypse Now and who wrote the screenplay for Full Metal Jacket, he originally met Stanley to talk about writing Eyes Wide Shut. It was well before Full Metal Jacket,
right.
That could have easily, Full Metal Jacket may have become the last film that he ever made. Fortunately for me, I had the pleasure of working with him, and it was an extraordinary experience. You asked me what it was like when we first met, and everybody had an opinion about Stanley, and there'd been so many books that were written about him, and I got tired of people telling me stories about him and how they knew him, and he did this and he did that. He was terrified of flying. He had airplanes fly over his house to spray for mosquitoes. He wore a football helmet when he drove a car. I mean, all these were kind of ridiculous stories that you heard about him. So I made a decision that I wasn't going to listen to them anymore, and I wasn't going to read anything else about him and just go meet him. And, of course, when I met him, he was one of the most congenial, bright, enthusiastic, loving fathers I'd ever met. His love for his children and for his animals was extraordinary. And what he did, what I say is that he was the most independent filmmaker I've ever had the pleasure of working with. That he created an environment for himself where he could make his films over the period of time that he did. He didn't live an extravagant lifestyle, so he didn't have, you know, a multi-million dollar mansion in Beverly Hills that he had to do upkeep on and pay taxes on. He lived way outside of the center of England, where he could concentrate on his work and be passionate about the thing that he was passionate about, you know, to deeply immerse himself in the experience of filmmaking. He was very social, you know, he'd go out and see plays sometimes, but where he was most social, because he was so far away from everybody, was on the telephone. And he's sort of famous for these historic 10-hour conversations on the telephone.
Wow, 10 hours.
I had several of those kind of sessions. And, you know, you talked about everything from the war to, you know, who was going to pitch next year for the Yankees.
Oh, that's great. So when you were filming Full Metal Jacket, and you came to a point during your performance when you just had doubts about how you were going to play Private Joker, how did Stanley Kubrick give you words of wisdom and inspiration and direction, really?
Well, all of his directions were very simple. You know, for instance, when we were walking into the city of Hue through the palm trees and smoke and things like that, he came over to me and he said, "Act scared," which was, you know, I mean, it's very direct, very simple, and to the point. And that is, in fact, exactly what was the appropriate direction to give to a young actor, was to act scared. A criticism of acting, of a performance in a scene might be, "Matthew, you're not going to do it that way, are you?" You know, I mean, it's very direct, and you go, okay, he didn't like that, I'll have to try something else, try a different approach. But the best advice that I got from him when I was having that doubt was because I felt like I didn't know what I was doing and I didn't know how to play the part. And he said, look, I don't want you to play anything. I just want you to be yourself.
Right.
And as he drove off and left me standing there thinking and making notes in my diary, what I wrote down was, I know that the important part of his sentence was to be.
Mm.
And because this is the journey that every artist has, it's what will make your radio program different than someone else's is when you embrace who you are.
Yeah.
And be yourself, you know, try being yourself because everybody else is taken.
Yeah.
You know,
well, that's great advice. That is really great advice.
Yeah. Trying to do that.
I mean, there's nobody that, and people discover it earlier than other people in their lives. I mean, Jack Nicholson is somebody who was very comfortable with who Jack Nicholson was mm-hmm. from a very early age. And we love him for who he is and his, you know, the quality of his performances. He's not trying to be Marlon Brando. He's not trying to be James Dean. He's not trying to be somebody else. He's Jack Nicholson.
Mm-hmm.
And you can look across the history of famous people that are comfortable with who they are and they be themselves. And we know who they are, whether it's any of those actors I just mentioned or John Huston, you know, as a director, that he wasn't trying to make movies like somebody else. He was trying to tell stories that were important and passionate to him.
Mm. Well, Ali Ermey, hopefully he wasn't like that all the time because he was terrifying. Is it true that you didn't meet him into the shoot till you were about to start shooting?
No, I don't know how that rumor got started because Lee Ermey was hired as a technical advisor on the film. And because we shot Vietnam before we shot Boot Camp, Leon, who was there from the get-go. He was there as I was. I was there months before we started shooting to start preparing, and so was Lee. So Lee was there from the beginning, and Lee always said that this part was written for him. And there was another actor that was cast, a wonderful actor named Tim Pulcheri, who becomes later on in the film the door gunner who's shooting women and children.
How do you
shoot women and children? Easy, you just don't lead them as much. That mm-hmm. guy.
Yeah.
that was the man that was going to be the drill instructor. And when Stanley saw Lee Ermey on tape auditioning the guys that were going to be the extras and heard the things that came out of his mouth and saw, because he wasn't playing, it was an example of being that Lee Ermey was that person, and he wasn't playing the part, and so he became the drill instructor.
Well, another great scene in the film is in the latrine with Vincent D'Onofrio as Private Pyle. What an amazing performance from Vincent D'Onofrio. Just tell us about working with him and, of course, filming that scene in particular. It's just one of the most haunting scenes in the entire movie.
Yeah, we worked on that quite a bit, you know, and talked about it, that what are the right words to say in a circumstance like that.
Mm.
And we actually, I mean, everybody thinks that everything with Stanley Kubrick's films was really laid out and you know, like a piece of Beethoven sheet music. But it wasn't. There was always room for discovery and rewriting. And so we worked on that scene. And through improvisation, you know, me, like Stanley saying, what would you do in a situation like this? And then we'd start to, you know, improvise the scene. And Stanley kind of wonderfully said, it's the right sentiment. It's just too many words. So how do we reduce that? How do we get it down to a reduction? Mm. And I'd say this about most artists like Stanley Kubrick or Picasso or Matisse, Gauguin, that in the ends of their careers or later on in their careers when they'd really mastered their art, it was always about reduction. It was about the line, you know, it was about how do you make a stroke on a painting and make it pure. And so when you watch Full Metal Jacket, it is absolutely a film with such simplicity. It's amazing. Mm. It's so simple. It's just the work of a master filmmaker. And that story, that film, that same script put in someone else's hands might come off as a kind of pro film, pro-war film, a propaganda film, something that made war look romantic, something that made it look kind of appealing. And with Stanley, by not really commenting on anything, but just presenting images and presenting a story, that's the work of a master.
It's a great perspective.
Yeah,
that's really great
perspective.
Yeah, it also
means it's quite timeless as well. So what would you say your favorite memories of working with Kubrick, and do you have a favorite Kubrick film, maybe outside of Full Metal Jacket?
Yeah, I really love Paths of Glory and The Killing, the racetrack
first,
movie.
Yeah.
I mean, Dr. Strangelove, absolutely. I mean, it's just brilliant. It's just brilliant.
Well, listen.
But what is my favorite Stanley Kubrick story?
Or just any memories you have that you
like
want to
like a special memory that you have. Maybe he bought you a cup of coffee and put two sugars in it. Who knows?
I think, you know, now that he's passed away, I'm gonna expose him and say that I used to go over to his house and watch movies.
Oh, great.
Because he had a projector, so he'd order the movies from a studio and they'd send him the reels, and he didn't want to hire a projectionist to do the reel changes, so we'd watch them one reel at a time, which is wonderful because we could watch a reel and then discuss it and try to anticipate what was going to come in the next reel. So the discussion between reels was really, really quite extraordinary and fun. But at those screenings, he had his big old Labrador Retriever, and the dog quite often passed wind.
Oh, jeez.
The question always was it the dog passing wind or was it Stanley? Because he was always blaming the dog.
Well, we got to tell you know, coming from two film geeks like me and Alicia, getting the chance to watch movies with Stanley Kubrick must have been really, really cool.
Oh, I would have loved
yeah.
to do that.
Yeah.
But listen, we're really grateful for your time and generosity in sharing these stories. And Matthew Modine, thanks so much for joining us. And everyone, please go to iTunes and check out Appumentary
yeah.
on Full Metal Jacket. It is a doozy. You'll want to check it out. Matthew, again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Pleasure speaking with you both.
Thank you. Have a great day. Wow.
That was cool. Can you imagine being a fly on the wall and watching movies with Stanley Kubrick?
That is film 101 in the extreme. Can you imagine, like, could have been anything. You could have watched like Star Wars or something.
Well, funnily enough, when Kubrick wrote down his favorite movies, amongst ones like Eraserhead was White Men Can't Jump.
Stanley Kubrick liked what? See, you never know.
Never know.
You never know what a man's going to like. Okay, we were going to hit on quiz show.
Oh, okay.
Okay, now right. let's now test our knowledge. Okay, you go first.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
Mr. Metz.
Yes, Miss Malone.
What movie did Kubrick have the cast of The Shining watch in preparation for that film?
Okay.
So which of these movies?
Yes.
Was it Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Was it Invasion of the Body Snatchers? Was it Eraserhead or Nosferatu? Which of those films do you think he made the cast watch to prepare themselves?
I'm going to say Texas Chainsaw.
No!
No!
Eraserhead.
Eraserhead? What? How?
You love David Lynch.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
That is really good to know. Okay, my question for you, my friend, is which of the following actors were not considered to play the part of Jack Torrance in The Shining?
Oh, gosh, okay.
Was it Robert De Niro?
Mm-hmm.
Was it Robin Williams?
Mm-hmm.
Was it Al Pacino?
Yep.
Or was it Harrison Ford?
Robin Williams?
Al Pacino! Al Pacino was not considered.
But Robin Williams was?
Robin Williams was.
Wow.
And he thought he would have been too funny. It was, I guess, a little too early, too close to when he's doing Mork and Mindy.
It was pre-1 hour photo, yeah.
I would have been interesting to see Harrison Ford in that role. Although, let's face it, you cannot top Jack Nicholson as Jack Torrance.
Oh, you cannot at all. All right. So, do we have time for
one more? We have time for our next Fast Five.
Fast Five. Number three is Chate. It's coming.
Coming with number three on our top Fast Five.
There we go.
There we go.
Clockwork Orange.
Boy, that's just hearing that music and hearing what's going on in that scene. It's all you really need to hear to just hit home the power. Now, this is number three on our list, but this is actually your personal number one favorite Stanley Kubrick movie, Alicia Milone, I Gotta Know Why.
I know this would surprise quite a few people because I'm very nice.
You are very nice.
But I like a film that disturbs me. I'm going to put it out there. I like a film that makes me think and makes me feel something. And Clockwork Orange is definitely disturbing. The way it looks at psychiatry and violent youths and set in dystopian London. Alex DeLarge is, as we said before, one of the scariest characters created on screen.
Yeah.
And I was rattled after seeing the film for the first time. I didn't know if I liked it or not. Then when I went back and watched it again, I really enjoyed it. I love the dialogue too.
Mm-hmm.
As I was saying before, the eggy wags and I vidied this. And it's just a whole different world.
And that he followed 2001 A Space Odyssey with a movie like Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, I mean, 1971.
Could the movies have been, those two movies have been any more different?
Mm-mm.
And that goes back to what we were saying at the top of the show, that he would take chances and do completely different films. This one was extremely, extremely controversial.
Mm-hmm.
And there were so many copycat crimes at the time and threats to Kubrick's family that after 61 weeks of playing in UK cinemas in England, that Stanley Kubrick pulled that movie and it was not shown in public in the UK until 2000 after he died.
That's his power.
That is that he had the power to pull the movie, yet it was still second to My Fair Lady as the highest grossing movie in Warner Brothers history.
Yeah, and he also told Warner Brothers exactly how he wanted the film to be marketed and they followed his wishes, which really paid off. I love that during filming, Stanley and Malcolm became really close. They used to play ping pong together. Malcolm says he always used to win. But then after filming, Malcolm thought he had a friend for life, but Stanley never contacted him again.
That's, you make a movie like that and you bond with someone in that way.
You have to feel safe to go that dark.
And to just like cut it off, clean break, move on, never see or hear from the person again after making a movie like that. Well, you have the movie to show for your relationship.
Exactly. Nominated for 4 Oscars, but what does Schmoville say about it?
Schmoville says, our friend Douglas Scarborough says, Clockwork Orange is basically 3 short films in one since all 3 acts are very different. Very, very good point, Douglas.
Yeah.
It is a film that affected me very deeply and I couldn't stop thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Neither could we and neither could she.
No, I could not stop thinking about it and it is a film that I like to revisit quite often. It's a movie that Kubrick wasn't even planning to make because he was set on his Napoleon film.
Oh, wow.
And he did so much research for that movie. You could have seen that in the LACMA exhibit that he had bookcases full of Napoleon books and he had 25,000 index cards with research. He never got to make it, but I'm glad he made Clockwork Orange.
I am too. And I'm also glad he made The Shining because
yes,
like Clockwork Orange and like 2001, The Shining is a film that has inspired not just filmmakers, but film geeks and nerds like you and me, Alicia Milone, to read into these movies, read into them so much to find hidden meanings that a filmmaker named Rodney Asher went ahead and made a movie called Room 237,
fantastic,
which is the room in the Overlook Hotel where Jack Nicholson sees the old woman. And this is an extraordinary movie about the power of movies and subtext that inspired 5 different people to come up with their own conspiracy theories about what The Shining was really about. Joining us on the phone right now, we are thrilled to have Rodney Asher, the director of Room 237. Rodney, thanks for joining us on Profiles with Scott and Alicia.
Sure thing. Good to talk to you guys.
No, so nice to talk to you. I saw Room 237 at Sundance.
Me too.
And I was so amazed by it. I couldn't believe that people read into The Shining so much. Why do you think The Shining, over all the other Kubrick movies, gets this kind of obsession about it?
Well, because it's the one with the most hidden secrets.
Yeah.
but also, I think, you know, at least as much as some of the others, it's such a perfect, you know, kind of Venn diagram of, you know, art and entertainment. You know, just on the surface, it works as a tremendously successful, involving, and entertaining horror movie. But there are so many loose ends, you know, you find yourself driven to revisit it again and again just to figure it out.
Well, how did you come to find the five people interviewed for Room 237. And in addition to how did you find them, why did you restrain from showing them on camera? Because you just hear their voices. You never actually see who these people are.
Well, me and Tim Kirk, who produced the film, spent, I don't know, 8 months or so, you know, researching as many of these ideas as we could. Though they weren't all in place when we started the film. You know, the two that you know, we had, you know, sort of lined up, you know, and that we saw as, you know, absolutely mandatory at the get-go were Bill Blakemore, who kind of got the ball rolling in the 80s when he wrote his article, you know, that was syndicated in American newspapers about the Native American theory.
Wow.
And then Jay Widener, who talked about, you know, all the allusions to the moon landing, you know, on a... we came across an essay that he had written online. So, you know, the time since, you know, we started making 237, he started making his own DVDs, and he's got at least two of them done, and a third is on its way.
Mm. Whoa.
And then, you know, from there, one person kind of led to another, and, you know, there were more than we could ever hope to get in.
Mm.
So we tried to, you know, pick people who either had different backgrounds or had wildly different ideas that might kind of complement, you know, the ones that were already inside. The author Jonathan Lethem has written a lot about Stanley Kubrick, though actually very little about The Shining. And when I met him at a book reading, you know, I was hoping he might be interested in participating or might have some interesting thoughts. And what he wound up doing was pointing me towards the guy, Jonathan Ryan, who had orchestrated a forwards-backwards projection at a theater in Brooklyn.
Really crazy. Really crazy.
It's so amazing what people do to try and find these secrets inside The Shining. Were there people that you considered, but then you thought, oh, they're a little too crazy, I can't include them?
Well, I mean, crazy is a tricky word in this context.
Yeah.
The movie itself is a crazy horror movie about crazy people driven mm-hmm. to obsession. So, I mean, just on the surface of the original film, you know, there's some pretty challenging far-out material before you get into the subtext, many of, you know, which is, you know, a lot of which was, you know, coming from, you know, Freudian, you know, like a Freudian text on, you know, the meaning of fairy tales. So, you know, being too outrageous wouldn't have been a problem. There were a couple I couldn't understand.
I bet.
and some that were maybe too involved. And then there were two, you know, maybe big fish that got away. You know, there's this guy in the UK, Rob Ager, who has a website where he principally focuses on Kubrick films, but he's talked about some others. And of the Kubrick films, you know, he's talked at the most length about The Shining. And, you know, he goes into a detail that shames anything that we were able to do in Room 237. And then, of course, there was the mastermind, you know, whose writing inspired the forwards-backwards projection. And although I wasn't able to get him for the film, I took tremendous satisfaction out of being able to coerce him into doing a commentary track for the DVD.
Oh, great.
Cool.
That is excellent. But I would love to know, what reaction you got from the Kubrick estate after Room 237, when it was shown at Sundance, but more when it was released and it was out there and people could really see it. Like, did anyone from the Kubrick estate call you and go, dude?
Well, you know, I never talked to anyone from the estate directly. You know, when the, you know, certainly there have been interviews, you know, where Jan Harlan has been, you know, fairly critical. You know,
I'll bet.
You know, which is fair. You know, if everybody in our film looks at The Shining differently, certainly everybody, you know, is going to look at 237 differently, and his experience is going to be radically different than a general member of the audience. I never had too many in-depth conversations with anyone out there. I mean, at the outset of this, you know, when me and Tim were trying to get our heads around, you know, what was the tack we were going to take with this. You know, there were ideas of, do we want to talk to people who worked in the cast? Do we want to talk to members of the cast and crew? Do we want to, you know, find Diane Johnson and talk about how the script came to be? But ultimately, we decided to keep the focus really, really concentrated on the audience, you know, and not on the people behind the scenes. So, you know, from the get-go, you know, we were kind of steering away from,
the original cast and crew.
Well, it's so interesting with The Shining because, I mean, we hear so often that Kubrick is a perfectionist, that nothing in his films is not there without reason.
Correct,
but yeah. There are so many lapses in continuity with The Shining. What do you think? Do you think they're deliberate?
Well, I mean, the simplest way to explain it is that he had other priorities.
Mm.
You know, one could say, you know, that priority was on composition or on performance or something else, and that kind of detail, you know, was of less interest. Personally, I'm very attracted to the idea, you know, that they may be something kind of like atonal notes that are supposed to make you feel subtly uncomfortable.
Mm.
You know, that something's wrong, but we're not sure exactly what from shot to shot. Not that I've you know, been able to confirm or deny that, you know, in any concrete way, but I find that idea, you know, very, very attractive.
It is.
Well, in one conspiracy theory that's explored in room 237, and Alicia is wearing a T-shirt that sort of backs that up right now. She's wearing the Apollo 11 shirt that Danny wore in the movie.
Awesome.
Is that The Shining contained all these clues about how Kubrick faked the moon landing? And this past summer at the LA Film Festival, there was a stage reading for a Stephanie Folsom's screenplay. It's called 1969: A Space Odyssey, or How Kubrick Learned to Stop Worrying and Land on the Moon. And I was wondering if you had a chance to go to that reading or hear about the screenplay and just your thoughts about what the conspiracy theories that people are taking to that level because of a movie like The Shining.
Well, I mean, that one is that one is so juicy. I you know, it makes perfect sense to me that I'm not the only person to have read about that theory and found it really fascinating and attractive. And actually, I think that I heard that there was another, you know, narrative film on the same idea. One that we have already shot with, I forget the actor's name. He was in The City of Lost Children and Hellboy.
What's his name? Ron Perlman.
Yeah. I thought that I had read that somebody had shot a film, you know, on the subject that he was in.
Oh, I'm going to have to check that out on IMDb.
It's also a music video by Imagine Dragons that stages it. They also get into Paul is Dead imagery, which is kind of fun.
Paul is Dead. But, I'm a big Beatles fan, so you're speaking my language now.
All right, well, you got to check out the video, which, bizarrely enough, a friend of mine that I know from the world of Funny or Die and some comedy videos that I used to do plays Stanley Kubrick with Hertford in that one.
Wow.
Well, listen, we are thrilled to have you on the show today, and you can watch Room 237. It's on iTunes. It's also on Netflix. That's where I watched it just recently. So absolutely, if you're watching this Profiles with Malone and Mann special on Stanley Kubrick, you have to see Room 237.
Fascinating.
It'll blow your mind,
yeah.
Rock your world. And Rodney, you rocked ours. Thank you so much for calling in.
We really
appreciate your time.
That was your thing. Great to talk to you.
Great to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Yeah, I remember seeing that at Sundance, I said, and I was just so fascinated by it. All the hidden clues in there, are they real? Some seem to make sense. Some are just so insane.
Their arguments are valid.
Yeah.
I mean, they're crazy, but they back it up.
They do. They've really studied that film.
And you just can't argue against it because of the arguments that these people are making in the film.
Exactly.
But I just also love that a movie... that first of all, you saw it at Sundance, which is a great place to see a movie like that. But that a movie about a movie that, you know, movies just inspire people in so many different ways. Like you said, you'd like disturbing movies because it moves you. It
makes me feel something.
It makes you feel something. And it made these five people feel something too.
So much.
But then there are some movies from Stanley Kubrick that are a little overrated.
Maybe don't make us feel so good.
And make us, maybe they're a little, just plain awful. Well,
maybe they're underrated.
Maybe they're underrated, but this is what we call the good, the bad, and the ugly.
And I think we are opposite on the first two.
I think we are.
What would you say is your underrated?
My underrated Stanley Kubrick movie, no question, is Eyes Wide Shut.
It's
Stanley Kubrick's final film. Whoa, okay, wait a minute. We're usually on the same page here, Alicia Malone.
Okay, tell me why you like it.
Well, first of all, Eyes Wide Shut is the first movie I ever reviewed, and that was a game changer for me. That changed the course of my life. A Stanley Kubrick movie, his last film, changed the course of my life. So for that, I am grateful for it. Mm-hmm. Not a perfect film.
No.
And I feel like if he had lived long enough to see the release of it, because he died like 3 or 4 months before it came out, I feel like he would have tweaked it a little more, maybe cut out some time, because even after 2001 came out, the day after its New York premiere of 2001, Stanley Kubrick cut 17 minutes from that movie. And I think maybe that's why it's your overrated?
Yeah, it's my overrated film. I like it, but I have a feeling that people love this film because it's made by Kubrick.
Okay,
if
fair.
If it was made by anyone else, they wouldn't love it so much.
Why do you think so?
I just think it's long.
It is long.
It's like it's a 90-minute movie stretched out to 2.5 hours. And for an erotic film, it's not very sexy.
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you think that if Eyes Wide Shut had come out in, let's say, 1971 versus 1999, do you think it would have been more relevant and it would have been a little more like convincingly erotic?
Well, it's interesting to hear that he was planning on making that before Full Metal Jacket. I think so. I think it would have been better. But my underrated is your overrated. Lolita.
Lolita, great.
Why is it? Lolita.
I thought it was fine.
Yeah.
I thought it was fine. I guess in the analysis of Stanley Kubrick movies, it's not one that I will go back to. It's not one that I will hold up to a certain standard. Peter Sellers is great in the film.
Yeah, he stole the show for me, and that's why I like it. I thought they captured the black tone of the book, but without making a straight remake.
Okay, can we at least agree on the ugly?
I think we can.
At least ugly in terms of Kubrick's role, because there's no bad Stanley Kubrick movie, but I think the one that I liked the least.
Yes.
The one that we liked the least was Barry Lyndon.
3 hours, 23 minutes.
Talk about too long.
Too long.
Okay, but it's a beautifully shot film. The way they shot with natural light and all the candles and everything, the cinematography is breathtaking. Ryan O'Neill gives a fantastic performance, but it is tedious, and I hate to use the word because you could say this about other Kubrick movies too, even though they're not true, but that it's boring.
Yeah. Well, what is not boring in your opinion? What is your right stuff, your favorite scene?
My favorite scene from any Kubrick movie comes from 2001, Space Odyssey. Well, there are two of them from 2001. One we already talked about is when David Bowman is deactivating Hal and he starts losing his mind. But my favorite scene isn't so much a scene as it's a moment.
Mm-hmm.
It is the moment when the Moonwatcher ape, after killing the other ape with the bone at the watering hole, in a fit of rage, maybe in a fit of shock, triumph, you don't know, because Ape had never killed another ape before. It sounds like a line from Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, it does.
But it does, right?
Don't
have Planet of the Apes. Ape has killed Ape. He chucks the bone in the air, and just the scream, that slow motion, he just chucks the bone in the air, and as the bone is falling, the cut to the space station, that the weapon, the spy satellite, and 4 million years, that one weapon and another weapon go hand in hand. And
I
what
love
has
that
really,
transition.
Really changed. And then you hear, dun, 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 dun.
Well, save your thoughts.
Yes.
2001 is coming. It might even be next. No, it's not. But our Fast Five number two favorite movie is?
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Dr. Strangelove.
Or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb.
1964, a satire. Very funny, also very scary.
Very scary, very shocking. This was the height of the Cold War. And this was the year after the movie Failsafe came out, which was a very dead serious depiction of what can go wrong with the bomb. And now here's a movie that makes fun of it, but is just as impactful for different reasons. Screenplay is sharp and smart and witty. The performances are fantastic, including
Peter Sellers.
All three from Peter Sellers. Mein Führer! I can walk!
He is brilliant. And apparently during filming, Kubrick would just be on the floor laughing. No one can make him laugh quite as much as Peter Sellers. And, you know, Kubrick does so many takes. So Peter Sellers just kept amping it up and up and up. And
so
he does a brilliant job. Some of the action in the war room and the dialogue, especially in the war room, that made me think of Woody Allen. Oh, interesting. Dimitri.
Yeah, he went a little funny in the head.
Yeah, how do you think I feel?
How do you think I feel about it?
That reminds me of Woody Allen.
Well, I know you're sorry, Dimitri. I'm sorry, too. Yeah. It's so, you could just watch that scene. It could just keep going.
Uh-huh.
But that movie came out on January 29th, 1964, was nominated for 4 Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Director, Adapted Screenplay, mm-hmm. and, of course, Peter Sellers. But what's significant, it was the first time that an actor had been nominated for lead actor for playing 3 different roles.
Interesting.
And they were all great.
It was supposed to end with a big pie fight, and they actually shot this. But then in the end, Kubrick thought it was a little too farcical, made it a little too funny.
The end is actually pretty appropriate.
Yeah, I think it definitely suits it. But here's something that I'm sure you know because you love the Beatles. But the Beatles actually wanted to use a shot from Dr. Strangelove for one of their music videos. But Kubrick wrote them a letter because, you know, he wanted to make sure his films were preserved in the right way and used in the right way. So he wrote them a letter saying, I don't feel comfortable with this. I'm going to say no because using a piece of footage from my movie makes it seem like I'm using stock footage for my movie. And I don't want it to come across that. It could hurt the film.
Okay, let me get this straight. Here we are talking about Stanley Kubrick. And again, if you've watched the other 2 profile shows we've done, I've mentioned that I am really obsessed with the Beatles, yes. with a capital O.
Mm-hmm.
And here you are telling me something, Alicia, that I did not know about the Beatles. I didn't know that.
Hooray!
Hooray!
Mission accomplished.
Anytime I can learn something new about the Beatles makes it a great day indeed. So hats off to you, Alicia.
Especially
thank you for that.
Beatles plus Kubrick. Okay, we asked Schmoville their thoughts on Dr. Strangelove. Claudia Rose Weldon, who always writes fantastic comments, she said, it gets every element of satire right. The caricatures of actual people, the mere absurdity of some of the decisions they make, and parroting a touchy subject, namely the way the world was in the 60s on the brink of nuclear war. Without it, I don't think we'd have Mel Brooks, any of the Cornetto trilogy, or the upcoming film The Interview. Very true.
Well, Liam Leo Grant, who has also been a regular Schmoville. Dr. Strangelove is a masterpiece and the greatest satire black comedy ever created in film history. Peter Sellers, one of the greats, playing 3 characters perfectly. Yes, we agree, perfectly. Seemed challenging considering he was playing off the other screen legends. George C. Scott, yep, Sterling Hayden, James Earl Jones, and many more. But I can't believe, I believe what the film does perfectly is satire of the Cold War and war in general.
It definitely does that. And it still is funny today when you watch it.
Oh, it's hilarious.
Okay.
It's hilarious.
Before we get to our number one, let's quickly run through some directors who we think have been inspired by Stanley Kubrick. Of course, many of them have.
Many have.
But 3 in particular that we think we can definitely see Kubrickian.
Very Kubrickian is Terrence Malick.
Terrence Malick. Yeah.
Terrence Malick for sure. I mean,
both reclusive.
Very reclusive.
They both make a film, you know, every once a decade, maybe.
Whenever they want it.
Whenever they want. They have complete creative control,
and also just the cinematography, the just letting scenes play out naturally, being shot beautifully. I would argue, we definitely argue that no one shot a movie like Kubrick.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no one shot a movie like Malick either. Look at Thin Red Line, Days of Heaven, and even just a couple years ago with The Tree of Life, which was very, very much like 2001: A Space Odyssey. Who else?
When I saw Under the Skin,
ooh,
that was the first thing I said was Kubrick.
Kubrick.
It was directed by Jonathan Glazer, mm-hmm. and I liked in this film that they used the long-held shots, so just shots held for a very long time, and then the slow cross-dissolves, which Kubrick did a lot of. And when asked about the Kubrick tone of his film, Jonathan Glazer said, yeah, I picked his pockets, really. People say homage, but I probably stole his wallet.
Well, at least he fesses up.
He does have his own style, though, too.
No question about it. I mean, Sexy Beast is a great movie. David Lynch.
Mm.
And you think about David Lynch is when you know you're watching a David Lynch movie like Blue Velvet, especially Mulholland Drive, which is just a masterpiece, one of the best movies of the O's, mm-hmm. the aughts, whatever they call
the
them.
Naughties.
Yes, thank you. but yes, David Lynch, I just feel like his style, while his own, feels very Kubrickian.
Mm, it does, definitely. And they both were admirers of each other.
That's true.
It's fantastic. Okay.
That
Mr.
Mance,
it is time for our favorite Kubrick film in our Fast Five. Jeté, hit the music.
Ah, yes.
It has to be. It has to be 2001, A Space Odyssey. I know this is your favorite.
This is my favorite. This is my favorite Kubrick movie. This is one of my favorite movies of all time. Released on April 3rd, 1968,
yeah.
Just 3 months sooner than one of my other favorite sci-fi movies of all time, Planet of the Apes. So talk about a great year for sci-fi. This is a movie, it took me a very, very long time to wrap my head around the film, what's going on in the movie, which is basically, it's the evolution of human consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
That the apes touch the monolith on the Dawn of Man sequence,
yep.
They gain consciousness, and then the monolith disappears, it's buried on the moon. Only if the humans, people,
mm-hmm.
Only when they uncover the monolith on the moon, only when they can trace the beam to Jupiter, go out to Jupiter to see the big monolith,
yep.
Only then will they be worthy of advancing to the next stage of their evolution, which is what we see in the Star Child at the end of the movie.
Get it.
You get it?
I get it.
Finally,
now.
She gets it.
I
yes.
I get it. This is all about, of course, human evolution, as you mentioned. Extraterrestrial intelligence, and it features some of the most brilliant special effects ever. And it was very scientifically accurate, of course. Kubrick researched the hell out of it for a long time. Just recently, you know, there was a war between Samsung and Apple for their iPad and Samsung's tablet. So in a countersuit between Samsung and Apple iPad, one of their main arguments they were making was that the iPad was directly copied from 2001 Space Odyssey with the tablets that they have on board the Discovery. But I love how it's in different sections. I just think it's so clever. You can see so much into it. People didn't get it when it came out. What was it? 241 people, I think,
walked out of the premiere,
including Rock Hudson.
And he says, can someone please tell me what this movie is about? Well, you know, listen, that's why these movies, why so many of Kubrick's movies, they're just so great, because you go back to them and you want to watch them over and over again so that you get something else out of it. Amazingly, this movie, like a lot of his films, got mixed reviews when it opened.
Mm-hmm.
The New York Times called it somewhere between hypnotic and immensely boring.
Oh.
And Pauline Kael called it monumentally unimaginative.
Which I don't understand, because I could see how you might call it boring, maybe a little bit pretentious, but not unimaginative.
No,
it's one of the most imaginative movies I've seen.
Very imaginative. Well,
anyway, eventually it became the highest grossing film of 1968.
And it is still the ultimate trip. We hope you enjoyed the ultimate trip with us. Before we let you go, a couple of announcements.
Mm-hmm.
And December 2nd, if you love Stanley Kubrick, you're going to want to get the 10-disc Blu-ray box set, which has all of his movies from Lolita on to Eyes Wide Shut. But it also has two extra Blu-ray DVDs full of all sorts of documentaries never before seen.
I want it.
It comes with a 78-page hardbound book. This is coming on December 2nd, just in time for the holidays. For you film buffs, for us film buffs,
yeah.
We're going to have to get it for each other,
yeah,
because that
Christmas
would be the ultimate gift. Also, if you love Stanley Kubrick, do check out the website Kubrickian.org. That's Kubrickian.org, run by Scott Scheckman. Big Kubrick buff, inspired by Eyes Wide Shut, just like I was.
Yeah.
That's Kubrickian.org. And again, if you are watching, we need your help. Please support Malone and Mance by rating us on iTunes. We need your comments, your reviews, your ratings. Please, please, please go to iTunes and rate Profiles with Malone and Mance.
Yeah.
Who do we have next week?
Next week, we're going big. One of our favorite filmmakers,
Martin Scorsese.
That is going to be huge. How do we choose 5 movies that we love of his? I don't even understand. But you might like to tell us what you love about Marty, which films you love. Make sure
Marty.
You hit us. Yeah, I know him. Marty, we shared an elevator once. He looked down the whole time. Anyway, you can join our Facebook page and leave your comments there and on YouTube below.
Well, that wraps up another fun episode of Profiles with Malone and Mance. Taking us out, Jatay, what do we got?
Thanks so much, Schmoville. See you next time.
See you next time, Schmoville.
But
from producers Christian Harloff, Mark Ellis, and the entire Schmoes No Network crew, we would like to thank you for listening to Profiles with Alicia Malone and Scott Matz. Special thanks to Kevin Undergaro and Maria Menounos, the author of Every Girl's Guide to Diet and Fitness, in stores now. Be sure to subscribe to Profiles on iTunes and rate and review the show. To get other Schmoes No Network episodes, movie news, and join the conversation, be sure to visit SchmoesNo.com. I'm the Pit Boss, and this has been a presentation of the Schmoes No Network. Hey.